all, you're very welcome to episode 4 of the 3D Design Bureau podcast. We shoot the breeze on all things surrounding the AEC sector and 3D design. And today we are joined by a very special guest, Owen Riley, Managing Director of Owen Riley. So, Owen, how are you?
Hi guys, I'm great, thanks. I'm great, thanks for having me on.
Good stuff, delighted to have you on. I have to say, during the week we dropped off a microphone to you and got to see your offices there in Grand Canal Dock. I don't know how you get any work done at all with those views.
Yeah, no, it's obviously a great neighbourhood, and it's great to see it kind of vibrant again, because COVID had quite a big impact on the neighbourhood, as you can imagine, given all the large offices. So it's great to see a buzz around Docklands again.
Have you actually, that's interesting, have you seen over the last month or so, or last few weeks, a big change in the footfall?
Oh yeah, it's like night and day, Nick. There were times there, particularly last year, where it was just so quiet. And because obviously there's a whole kind of ecosystem that feeds off the large offices, whether it's the coffee shops, the restaurants, the small businesses like mine. So I think that, given the kind of, it's kind of tech heavy down here. I don't like that word, Silicon Docks. It was the Dublin Docklands for a couple of hundred years, and a couple of hundred years from now, it'll still be Dublin Docklands. But I think that, given Google, Facebook, Airbnb, their staff can work from home, can work anywhere. Really, when at the onset of COVID and the lockdowns, a lot of the non-Irish technology professionals in particular chose to move home and work from there, But the great thing is, in recent months, a lot of those professionals are coming back. They're not all coming back. That much is clear, but some of the offices, some of Ireland's largest law firms are down here. PricewaterhouseCoopers are down here, so there's a lot more going on down here than technology. And certainly the more traditional sectors, they have their offices kind of half full at the moment, it looks like to me.
And in terms of your own business, just what's the split sort of on sales versus renting? Because you do both sides, don't you? You look after the rental sector for landlords and then the sales. So is it an even split, or are you more in one side than the other?
I'd say with this stage, like, we've really built up a large portfolio of rentals in the Docklands and really across Dublin at this stage. I suppose the Docklands is very important to my business, but we're very active across Dublin at this stage. And I would think, the sales market is very cyclical, and it really depends on supply and demand. One issue for agents over the last kind of 18 months has been low supply, and this is why we've seen the kind of heat in the market. It's been a good time for sellers, but a big factor of that is low supply, and low supply means low transactions for agents. So I would say at this stage we're probably about 50-50 between rentals and management and sales.
One of the things actually that I was quite shocked at, because I heard you talking on, it was News Talk recently, and I've seen you put stuff on LinkedIn, was how much of the small landlords make up the rental market. Because I think there's probably a notion, not a notion, but there's some idea out there amongst many people that it's the large, the large firms that are, renting stuff out. But it's kind of like the SME sector, where small to medium businesses make up the vast majority of the economy. So I was quite shocked to hear of how much there is with the smaller tenants, the one or two properties, and how much that gives to it, and then the amount of the exodus that you're seeing in the market at the moment.
Yeah, no, it's very concerning. I mean, the rental market has got so dysfunctional that neither landlords nor tenants are happy with it. As you said it there, the vast majority of landlords own one or two properties. For many of them, these properties are their pension. I kind of call them mum and dad investors. Mom and dad landlords. And I think at a time where we need all available accommodation, our data over the last three quarters, so for example in the last quarter it was 59% of our sellers across Dublin were landlords. It was 54% in the quarter before that, and then in quarter one, over 60% of our sellers were landlords exiting the market. And you know, there's many reasons for that. High taxation will be one. Rising prices. We're in a rising market, so that's encouraged some landlords to exit. But there are other things as well. The RTB have a big part to play in this. I'm on the record in many places about how inefficient they are from a landlord's point of view in terms of, so for example, how long it takes to get a bad tenant out of a property, or a tenant who stops paying rent. There was a lot of sweeping measures brought in during the COVID crisis to protect tenants, and they were needed, but unfortunately a small number of tenants abused that protection. And if so, for example, we had some landlords who couldn't get a non-paying tenant out for over a year, and we couldn't issue termination notices. So of course that landlord, after an experience like that, just wants to get out of the business of being a landlord. I was talking before about the taxation. Like, for some landlords, the margins are very tight. It is a kind of a, you know, maintenance can be intensive, can be expensive. And COVID, of course, had quite a big impact on the rental market in the city centre initially last year, where rents probably fell an average 10 to 20%. And again, that for some landlords, that was just the final curtain, really, on being a landlord. I would hope in time some of them will reinvest in the market again, perhaps through their pension. We are seeing a lot of landlords investing through their buying properties through their pension, and all the advantages that come with that. But yeah, I mean, and unfortunately, what does this mean? In short, it means the accommodation crisis in Dublin, but really in every urban area in Ireland, is going to get worse before it gets better. And unfortunately, that is now unavoidable.
And do you think now, with the accommodation crisis that we have, do you think it's solvable in the next, say, like, by the sounds of it, and from a lot of commentary that's coming around the sector, that we're looking probably easily 2 or 3 years before it sort of flushes out and before some stability comes back into it. Would you sort of subscribe to that sort of time frame, or do you think it's going to be longer? Do you think there's external, like, there's also then the thing to look at what's happening in China with Evergrande, and will that have an impact on us, you know? Like, what's your sort of take on the time frame side of things?
Well, there's a couple of things I would say. Yes, it's going to take time. I mean, we are dealing with the implications of the state not investing in housing for 3 decades now. And just to go back to small landlords, I would suggest they are punishing small landlords for that lack of investment. But that's another, you can have a whole podcast session on that. But I think we have a plan now, the Housing for All plan.
Do you think it's good? Have you, like, what's your take on it?
Plans are easy, Nick. Plans are really easy. You talk to someone in the construction sector about the lack of all kinds of labour and expertise. Finance is an ongoing issue. Take your point about Evergrande and the threat of contagion. But if the state is involved, you know, raising finance, etc., won't be a problem. But it takes a long time to develop a greenfield site into housing or into apartments. Takes probably maybe twice as long. So yeah, it's going to take at least 3 years before we see an improvement. And in the short term, you know, the state should be doing all they can to encourage landlords to stay in the business of being a landlord rather than leave it. There are encouraging signs around the number of new homes we're going to deliver this year. That number has been increased. I see we're going to deliver over 20,000 units. But we're one of the few countries in Europe that shut down its construction sites for months. And it takes a long time to ramp up. And the other thing I would say is it's really only in recent, or it feels maybe this year or maybe the end of last year, that the government have realised we're in an accommodation crisis. I think a lot more stakeholders were aware of that. And I think what I would say is that you saw when COVID first hit Ireland that the kind of emergency measures the government could bring in essentially overnight to limit how we live. And they responded with those kind of measures to an emergency. And I would suggest that they need to introduce more emergency measures to deal with the accommodation crisis. But look, we have a plan. Plans are easy. Now they've got to implement it.
Yeah, and that's interesting about the plan, because one of the things on one of the other podcasts we did about the old SHD process, which I'm sure you have an opinion on, the SHD process probably hasn't, like, on paper, looked great. Did it get executed? Not really. And then with the judicial review process that came in, like, that's been hanging around now for, like, there was a big watershed JOR back in March or something like that, on a scheme down in the sand down by Eastwall, and that, you know, caused all sorts of mayhem. And I think the JOR process, there's still problems around that, and that still hasn't been. Now, there was something in the paper recently over the weekend about trying to put costs on appealants now if their appeal for or their request for a JOR is not really substantial or it fails. But it needs to be sorted out. So it's kind of like, if they don't sort out, and on paper, as you said, things are great on paper, but if they don't sort out the foundation, which is planning, which is getting planning, which is going to building, they're not going to hit those target numbers, you know, of development.
100%. I think they need to act like they're in an emergency, and they need to sort out the roadblocks, and they need to, they need to do that now. So I don't know if it's a planning czar or whatever it is. But as you say, those roadblocks are there. The developers will tell you this is the number one issue other than financing that they're facing. And I think, call it emergency measures or whatever, they need to be brought in, and they need to be brought in ASAP. Given what the data is showing us, our data on the number of landlords leaving the market is matched by other firms as well. So the data is undeniable.
Yeah, doesn't lie. And yeah. Are you seeing landlords coming in? Is there, like, what sort of percentage of new landlords coming in, the mom and dad landlords? Is there people coming into the market not through their pensions, so just normally, or are people just staying clear of it now from a rental perspective?
You're right. Pension investing is, you have to have built up a fairly sizable pension to invest in a property with it. But encouragingly, like, in recent weeks, I've met a 28-year-old and a 29-year-old separately buying their first investment property, and they plan to build a portfolio up over time. One of them plans to have a dozen properties by the time he's 40 and to focus exclusively on that. So, despite the challenges, there are opportunities there. 30% of our buyers in the last quarter were investors, and we need them. So I still think property, if taking a long-term view, we all know what the deposit rates are offering us at the moment. Nothing. In fact, banks are going to be charging us now to even leave money on deposit. And, unfortunately, because of the lack of supply, I mentioned earlier how rents had fallen sharply because of COVID and how it changed how we work. Rents are going to be back to pre-COVID levels by quarter one. I've no doubt about that. Rents rose nearly 6% in the last quarter, according to our data. And that's before the likes of large employers like Facebook and Google have even reopened their offices. And that's going to happen in quarter one, hopefully. So there will be opportunities for landlords as well in the market.
And do you think like house prices, obviously, like, I know a couple of people that are purchasing houses at the moment, friends of mine from college and stuff, they're looking at moving and that, and they're mentioning it's just a bit of a feeding frenzy at the moment and prices going up. Do you see that continuing for the foreseeable future, short term, even over the 6 or 9 months, or do you see it cooling down at all in, say, 2022?
There's evidence in the last quarter that it's cooling down a little bit. Right now we have a number of properties in turnkey condition in the suburbs with multiple bidders on them. We put a property in the middle of Ranelagh on the market 2 weeks ago, 1.25 million, and there's bids in over 1.4 on that at the moment. But, you know, for every property selling with multiple bidders, there's another one not selling. To give you some context on that, in quarter three, our average selling price was just below 1% above asking, so about 0.88%. But in quarter two, it was nearly 5% above asking. I remember when the first lockdown ended June last year, our average selling price was 7.5% above asking. So what is happening? I suppose everyone is now looking for more space. Because of the supply issues we mentioned earlier and the cost of renovation has shot up 20-25% in a year, there's particular focus on turnkey properties that are close to amenities. And what's kind of happened with COVID is it's kind of accelerated the return of a lot of Irish people and Dubliners who were going to return anyway. Maybe some were going to leave London because of Brexit, but their return accelerated by the pandemic. And a lot of Irish people left America because of how they managed COVID initially, and Asia and places like that. So they've all come back at the same time. Some of these people have been hugely successful with their careers in these countries. A lot of them are cash buyers. 60% of our buyers in the last quarter are cash buyers, require no funding whatsoever. And that's happened exactly at the moment that a lot of non-Irish professionals living here, particularly technology executives, have decided to buy instead of rent. Dublin has become home. Maybe they've a partner here, maybe they've children here. They're now looking to buy at the same time all these Irish people have returned, and then you have the existing market here anyway. And they're all chasing the same houses in the same neighbourhoods. So what has changed in recent weeks? Some of that pent-up demand has dissipated, and there's been a welcome pickup in supply of homes to the market. So for example, in September and October, supply is similar to the levels we saw in 2019 after falling off a cliff last year. And really during the summer months, kind of July and August, traditionally quieter months, but we did have a lockdown earlier in the year. I was particularly concerned for my business with the lack of stock listings and transactions we were doing. But thankfully in September and October, there's been a welcome supply. So it's that old supply-demand dynamic. And so supplies increase, slightly less demand, and a little bit of heat has come out of it. Having said that, it is tough for buyers right now. In general, it's tough for buyers. It's a good time for sellers.
Are you finding though that the people who are coming back from abroad and also the people looking, the locally Irish people who are still here looking for houses, are they looking for a different type of offering in terms of their house, with the work from home, with hybrid working? That's probably most companies are going to use. I know we're talking about it. We haven't brought everyone back to the office yet, but we're going to wait out probably another few months, just see how the winter pans out. But are people now, like this, I suppose without new stock coming on the market, you still got your two bed apartments, your two beds, your living, kitchen, dining area. But are people starting to, are you getting requests for, look, we need the office, we need more space, you know, especially with houses and stuff like that?
Everyone's looking for more space, Nick. I guess, like, if you look at the apartment market last year, I have no problem selling. We sell and rent a lot of apartments here, but, you know, apartments were in general out of fashion last year because of the lack of space to work from home. So when you had suburban houses going up in values, in general, according to our data, apartment values fell about 5% last year. What we've seen this year, as the city has opened up again and a lot of what the city centre offers, the apartment market really only in the last kind of 3 months has seen a significant pickup demand. And while it's not quite as heated as the suburban housing market, there are signs in recent weeks that the demand for apartments has increased significantly. And for the first time, we're starting to see some apartments selling above asking or selling very quickly. We listed a penthouse recently in Grand Canal Dock at 1.5 million. And that went sale agreed in a couple of weeks. And that simply would not have happened last year. But to answer your question, everyone's looking for more space. I think what's changed a lot though this year is, in addition to more space internally and externally, they're also looking for turnkey or as close to turnkey as they can. Because as I said, that cost of renovation has gone up significantly. I think houses and apartments requiring renovation are a little trickier to sell, or there's certainly less demand for them compared to the turnkey. And, you know, turnkey properties in some cases are selling for serious premiums to reflect that they're just ready to move in. I do think people are looking at properties, both for sale and for rent in different ways. So for example, the young professionals, when looking at rentals, particularly, I know we're going to talk about virtual tours and all of that, but they're kind of looking at the space in bedrooms for a desk, or is the living area a little bit larger? I think in houses, people are looking for that home office, whether it's the attic conversion or potential to convert the garage or the showmer out the back in the garden. And I think we expect most people will be in the office 2 or 3 days a week. Some people I believe will be in every day. Others know they won't have to be in every day, and maybe everything's kind of a trade-off. So instead of maybe buying a house in Black Rock, maybe they can go a little bit further out into North Wicklow and get a lot more bang for buck. So I've definitely seen some examples of where buyers we're working with have kind of changed their criteria, particularly because everything used to start really with location. Whereas now I think people, given there's going to be more flexibility in how they work, how we all work, they're prepared to be a bit more flexible on the location if it gives them that more space and more value per square foot.
And Camille, you touched on the virtual tour, so we're obviously big fans of virtual tours, both the as-built and the pre-sales and stuff, and we do a lot of off-plans tours. How, like, obviously during lockdown, like the virtual tours and the Matterport tours were key to letting people see a property. Is it still booming for you? Do you still utilize that tool on most properties?
Yeah, we provide VR tours on all our listings, not just properties for sale, properties for rent also. And I think, they really did come into their own during the COVID era. As a business, we were able to continue with transactions where physical viewings were not possible or people did not wish to view physically. We conducted a huge amount of, like, half of our rental transactions from March up until June last year were virtual.
Wow. Like the actual closing of the transaction?
Of a rental transaction was, yes. Now obviously a tenant is thinking, well, I'm going to be here a year, so I'm not buying the property. When they understand that we did the tour ourselves with the camera, so it represents the property accurately, they were happy to rely on the VR tour. I would probably say right today about 10% of our tenants are renting properties based on the VR tour alone. So we are seeing this trend that we've tried to encourage, where a lot of our larger tech companies we work with in particular, instead of putting their employee in a short-term rental or in a hotel, let's conduct the transaction remotely or virtually. And when they fly into Dublin, they can go straight from the airport to their new rental property.
One of the things on the purchasing side, like, I think there are some agents that probably back, say, 2 years ago naively thought that, you know, you get a lot of people purchasing on the back of a virtual tour. I always said, look, it's just another stepping stone to get a buy-in from interested parties. It gets rid of tire kickers. So you have a more focused market targeting a market. Would you say that's probably a pretty fair reflection? Like, have you had anyone buy an apartment or a house directly from a virtual tour?
Absolutely.
Have you?
Out of pure necessity, Nick. Pure necessity. So there was a period of time there from March to June last year. And beyond that, in fairness, because there were Irish, I mentioned this trend of these Irish people returning home. So there was Irish people in New York, Washington, Australia, who wanted to buy a property but couldn't come and visit. So now we're talking about a small cohort of buyers here, but they were happy to buy unseen, relying on the virtual tour. What I would say is buying unseen using the VR tour has been a feature of the investment market and second home market for quite some time. You may be familiar, I've told this story before, about this lady in Auckland ringing me up a few years ago, about 4 years ago, saying she'd just done a VR tour on a penthouse we were selling in Hanover Quay. And she says, I've just done this VR tour, this is great technology. And I said, yes, it is. And she said, so I'm going to make you a full cash offer at the asking price, which was 1.5 million. And I said, that's fantastic. So when are you coming over to see it? And she said, I'm not coming over to see it. And I said, well, I think the owner and I would be have a little bit more confidence in your interest and in your offer if you actually came to physically see it or got someone to physically view on your behalf. And it was such an eye-opener for me, where she said, listen, have you emblemished this VR tour in any way? I said, no. And she goes, well, I've done the VR tour, and if you're saying it represents the property accurately, I'm making you an offer. Let's do a deal. I can CC my banker who will confirm proof of funds. And we did the deal. It turns out the lady had Irish roots. Her father was one of New Zealand's richest citizens. He was a man from Donegal who built a very well-known entrepreneur over there. And the first time she physically saw the property was that Christmas, where I handed over the keys for Christmas week, and she walked in around the property once and then jumped in a brand new Jeep she bought to drive down to Ashford for Christmas. they subsequently spent 600,000 euros renovating the property.
You're kidding me. So 1.5, yes. Brand new Jeep and 600 grand renovation.
Yeah. And would you believe I just sold it again about 3 months ago, because COVID changed their whole plans to use it as a European base for their family. But she bought it unseen, and at different stages last year and particularly this year, we sold probably about 15% of our properties, I think it was, virtually. So you might recall between January and April, physical viewings were banned, and there was a cohort of our clients who had agreed to sell their property before Christmas, signed a contract, and they had to move. There was no choice in the matter. They had to move, and those buyers relied on the VR tour.
It's been unbelievable. It's been unbelievable tech. Like we obviously track the company and where they're going. I personally don't agree with some of their business model and how they went about from years ago, and they got service providers in, then they started selling into the service provider clients, and I don't agree fully with their business model, but hey, you know, what am I to know when you're turning over X amount of hundreds of millions, like, you know. You're a big proponent of the online portal, or a portal for agents. Just explain that a little bit to the listeners, because it's something that's of interest to me as well.
Well, you know, in this digital age, the whole market really is online now, and I think from, you know, whoever controls the online market controls the market in effect, and I would say that it's the property portals that control the market. Agents are just a kind of a stakeholder in it. And I think, you know, while the properties are available online and, you know, the marketing is all online, essentially you can see the transaction is moving online. So whoever controls the online market is going to control the transaction and they control the market. So I've been saying for quite some time, it's in agents' interest that agents control the online market and or at least have a stake in it. And we've no stake in it at the moment. I think there's huge implications for that for agents, particularly that's become obvious really this year when we're in a low transaction market, because, you know, the model is you eat what you kill. And so transactions are down, fees are down. So despite, you know, everyone's talking about the property market now, thankfully now with COVID receding, but in general, most agents are not doing as well as they were a couple of years ago, because transactions are down, and really the only thing we're getting out of the transaction at the moment is a fee at the end, with no guarantee of you only get a fee if a property closes. So we're not getting anything from the transaction, from the online mortgages, for example, the data.
And do you see it as a as an online portal just made up of agents? Like how would you envisage something like that working?
I would love to see agents partnering with a portal tomorrow. This is something that I think will happen, and something that needs to happen. I think you know, the portals that are there, they're not sharing any benefits of the online market with agents. So at a time where some agents are barely breaking even, some portals are reporting millions in profit, and you know, it's gas when you think about it. Like, they are charging us to list our properties on their websites, and they are monetizing the transaction, they're monetizing the data, and they're not sharing any of the benefits of that with agents. And I think that needs to change.
Okay. And come here, so you've your main office is obviously down in Dublin Docklands, not the Silicon Docks or Silicon Dublin Docks, but you've got then the one in Milltown. How many other offices do you have?
We have an office in Milltown, which we kind of cover the South Dublin region, and then we have an office in Portobello in Dublin 8, which looks after kind of Dublin Central and obviously Dublin 8 itself. Dublin 8 is a huge market and one we're really interested in kind of grow our presence in more. We opened there because we kind of saw a synergy between our Docklands clients selling their apartments and buying a period house in Dublin 8 or in Dublin 6 for that matter. So we're in Milltown nearly 10 years, time flies.
Are you there 10 years?
Yeah, we're in Milltown 10 years. And we're in Portobello 5 years. So time really does fly. Personally, I believe, while I've no interest in having a branch on every neighborhood corner, I do think they serve a very important purpose to have that. I think you need to be on the ground in a neighborhood to be an expert in it. I think that having a physical presence, I think, is very important, and being kind of ingrained in a community. And I think that's hard to do it's hard to do working at home, and it's hard to do working in an office only in the city centre or in some business park in the suburbs.
And tell me this, because Kevin obviously is a marketing guru here. So he was keen. He was interested, weren't you, Kev, on the all virtual suite and stuff?
Yeah, the virtual suite. Well, that you mentioned with Matterport Tours. I suppose you invested heavily in that way before the pandemic hit, and you were kind of, it seems, ahead of the game. All the other kind of real estate agents around the country heavily invested once they could no longer do physical viewings. But I suppose as well as that, you're very good and on top of your marketing. It's hard to open TikTok even without seeing a class video of an apartment suite in the Dublin Docklands. So could you just touch on what your marketing strategy is and how you go about it?
Well, in the virtual tours, I bought into that a long time ago. I just think it's like, I'm in this business over 20 years, and I was never more excited than when I first saw one of those virtual tours. I just thought it was an amazing kind of technology. As you said, Nick, you know, going to view a property is very time consuming for the viewer, but also for the agent. You know, the amount of times in my career you would drive out to somewhere for 30 minutes on a Saturday morning to show someone around, and the moment they walk in the door, they know it's not for them. So I think, as you said, it's you know, when normality returns, of course, very few people are going to buy their property relying on a virtual tour alone. But it's a great tool to encourage people to come and see a place that perhaps they would have ruled out, or rule out, haven't seen it virtually because they just know, haven't seen the garden or the condition or how the rooms work or whatever it might be. It just means they can save time. So it's a fantastic tool to encourage viewings and give someone that kind of immersive experience of viewing a place. On the marketing suite, the virtual marketing suite, yeah, I thought I was ahead of the curve. So that's now become a branch, by the way, in the COVID era. So with physical distancing, there's four of my colleagues are now sitting in that office. But we set that up because we thought virtual marketing on new homes was going to be the way forward to sell off plans. So to give people a clearer idea on what it is they're buying, because I spent a lot of my career around 05, 06, 07 selling off plans, and that was just the old, you know, floor plan on the wall, and there you go, madam, that's your plot there, and maybe some kind of a sketch of what the view was going to look like. So I taught virtual marketing, 3D models on new home developments, was going to help people make the buying decision from the developer's point of view, get them the sales off plans that they need to de-risk this project, but also to get a premium on the price, because typically buyers when buying off plans would expect a discount. And that's because they were I suppose, taking a punt. You know, an idea of who the development team are and their track record always helped. But I think if you can show someone the inside of an unbuilt apartment, or and particularly show them what the view is going to be like, you know, the actual view, I think that was going to be the biggest development in new homes marketing in a generation. And unfortunately, and while I do think this is going to be, this will come back, and I really hope you and us do a lot of business in this area. Unfortunately, the emergence of the PRS sector has just killed it. Because you're just selling a whole block of apartments to an investment. In general, you're selling it to one investment fund, and their focus is just on what kind of
you're not dealing directly. Yeah, you're not dealing directly with it. It's nearly a ghost entity that you're dealing with. We have our off plans tours, like, we've been doing them for a number of years, good few years, but they really, when COVID hit and stuff, we sort of doubled down and started targeting that area of the business, and it did grow. It grew very well. It's continued to grow, and then we push out campaigns and stuff. I know we've got an inquiry late last week for a big development in somewhere in the UK, Kevin, for
in Manchester, yeah.
So and for full off plans tours, but it's not a PRS, it's a big apartment development. And they are, and generally, I suppose we work directly with the interior designers as well, and that's a big thing, getting the inside right. Because what I found, or what I do find, is if we get, say, 90% accuracy to the interior designs that are going to be put into the apartment, when a show unit's built and a potential buyer walks in, just the confidence that breeds, that they've seen it already online, so they're familiar with it. And it's an amazing tool. Like, so that's one of the, like, that we kind of, I suppose, with the off plans tours that we do, we kind of copied the Matterport, but just for off plans. But we did one recently down, I can't remember, I think it was Maynooth or Kildare somewhere. And I think off the off plans tour, they sold the first phase, was 35 houses or something. And we'd done two virtual show houses. Like, they got full bookings on all the houses, you know. So, yeah, they're a powerful, powerful tool, all right, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many reasons as well. Like, first of all, it's the reach. You can reach any buyer anywhere in the world using this technology. You know, marketing suites are great, but you have to physically visit it. And I think, you know, you can visit these tours anytime you want. You can reach any buyer anywhere you want in the world on any device. And it really is it's going to be the future of how we sell new developments in Dublin. The emergence of the PRS sector has stunted its growth a little bit. And don't get me wrong, we need these extra supply of rental income, of rental units, because we are in this accommodation crisis. But in general, the PRS sector has been a disaster for agents because of, in a lot of cases, the funds are doing the rentals themselves, and where they're not, the fees are very low. And I suppose from my point of view, a lot of developments that were block sold in Docklands, we would have hoped to have sold those to individual buyers using VOR tours on unbuilt properties. But unfortunately, just the market shifted to selling by block, which I totally understand from the developers.
But it needs that the housing sector needs that full gambit of properties, of different people in the properties, different renters, different owners. It needs it to stabilize it, doesn't it? It just can't be one. But we have this habit in this country, don't we? We just go into these, like, peaks and troughs of whether it's like supply and demand, or, you know what I mean, there's a boom in construction, then it falls off a cliff. We never seem to get that happy medium for the property sector.
Well, I mean, a lot of the time it's developer led. These projects are developer led. They're profit led, and that's capitalism. I get that. But, you know, I think what you're touching on there, Nick, is what does Dublin need right now? And has it been too much focused on hotels, offices, tourists, transient workers? Of course, we need all kinds of tenures of accommodation now. social, obviously. Affordable rental, a tenure we haven't had before. We need build to rent, but we also need private homes for people who want to buy a new home. And the one thing about a brownfield site in the city centre, once you develop that as a hotel, that's that use gone for 30 years. Another example would be we've built a lot of student accommodation, which a lot of students can't afford to live in. And I'm sure you've seen the change of uses to go back to short-term rental accommodation, which is just crazy. And those sites could have been what Dublin needs. And what Dublin needs urgently now is all types of accommodation there, as you touched on. And I think that's where I think maybe that planning czar needs to come in and remove the roadblocks and the delays, but also look at what do we actually need.
But in the meantime, we'll stick to TikTok and the Twitter and Instagram and the likes. Kevin put us on TikTok. You're on TikTok, are you? You are on TikTok.
Yeah, I'm on TikTok a few months, so I kind of started this, Kevin, as an experiment.
You're flying it. Yeah, it's an experiment.
Yeah, and I can't get over the engagement. And it's not all positive. I suppose we are in an accommodation crisis, and all I tend to do is just post videos of lovely properties. But I am trying to give people an insight into what these homes look like on the inside. But what it also tells me is how this generations N, I suppose, how they're going to buy and rent property, I think, 10 years from now. The engagement compared to other platforms like Facebook, it's just you couldn't even compare. Instagram's a little bit better, but the engagement on TikTok is just on another level.
Yeah, I suppose the organic reach you get on TikTok compared to those other platforms is chalk and cheese. It just, I suppose, from your point of view, is it the traffic you're getting on it as good a quality that you'd get from your other platforms, or is it more kind of, for us, it's we get good engagement on it, but we wouldn't necessarily get leads down the line. It's great for brand awareness, but it wouldn't be our main platform. LinkedIn would be our main platform for acquiring leads.
Yeah, no, 100%. I'm doing it for the exact same reasons you guys are. Brand awareness. I regularly, some of them are leaving comments saying, why are you posting this? We can't afford anything right now. What I'm kind of saying is, look, I'm going to be here in 10 years time. So when you make your money, you come and see me. So, it's brand awareness. I don't know if you've noticed on the videos, I'm not trying to sell them the properties. I'm not mentioning prices or including links to the properties. As I said, I'm just trying to give people an insight into what these homes are like on the inside. But it's also, other than the brand awareness and building the brand, it's I'm experimenting. And it's as I said, I just think the next generation, how they buy and rent properties is going to be very, very different to what we've seen in the past.
Yeah, it's great. You seem to be, you're ahead of the game with the virtual tours, and I think you're ahead of the game with TikTok and all the other social media platforms. But Owen, we've kept you for 43 minutes.
That's impressive.
So we have, and you're a busy man, so I don't want to keep you for much longer. I suppose, is there anything else you'd like to touch on? What's next for Owen Riley and your team? The stage is yours.
Yeah, it's interesting you asked that. I've only thought about that recently because no more than yourselves, my mindset when COVID hit was, how do I get through this? Because I would have been quite concerned about the market when COVID first hit March last year. Had a huge impact on my business straight away. Half of our sales fell through, for example, in March, and look, supply has been very low. My view is if we continue to offer a good service and get good results for our clients, they'll take care of us. But in short, the plan is to double the business over the next 2 years in terms of revenue and the size of the team. As a business, we're going to focus on the middle and the upper end of the market because honestly, that's where the margin is. This is a very low margin business with high costs, and it's a very transaction focused business. I'm hoping to generate new revenue streams. We were talking about the portals there earlier over the next couple of years, and certainly we will continue to innovate on the marketing where we can. I'm always looking to see what they're doing in other countries, particularly, and I'm sure you'll agree, Australia and America. Australia in particular seems to be ahead of the curve on the marketing side of things. And I would hope we will be more involved in the new home sector as development for private homes becomes feasible again. And I would hope we'll be able to do some really interesting things on the virtual marketing of those developments. And I do think that will come back. We're currently working on a project inside Dublin where the plan right now is we're going to focus on private buyers.
Good stuff. Nick, are you happy with that?
Yeah, happy with that. Thanks a million for coming on, Owen. It's you're our first out of the company guest, so I think it went really enjoyed it. Got some good insights into the industry, and like I'm always obviously, because you know I have a passion for property and architecture and the AEC sector, so I'm always trying to keep tabs on what's going on. So it's interesting to know. I was very interested to know about the short to medium term and where you think the market's going to continue to go. Good that you're seeing signs, I suppose, a little bit of cooling down. Some buyers might be happy with that. So yeah, I think it's been really good, and really appreciate you coming on and giving us your time, Owen.
It's my pleasure. Just one final point I would make before I go, because you're asking, you know, what could we do to help some buyers. I absolutely support the central bank lending rules around the 3.5 times your salary, because we know what happened when we unleashed or we allowed anyone to borrow whatever they wanted back during the Celtic Tiger era. But there is absolutely a case for a cohort of buyers now who have built up a rental history of paying a high rent, which demonstrates that they can pay a similar amount in a mortgage. And I do think they need to look at doing something for those people so that they can get on the ladder and maybe bridge that, you know, affordability gap, which really is kind of moving that multiplier from 3.5 times to 4 times your salary, which is, for example, what they have just over the border in Northern Ireland. So I do think they need to look at that. In general, I support the restrictions on not allowing people to borrow more than they can the manager or pay back. But there are a cohort of people who've been paying high rents now for 4, 5, 6 years. And with that kind of, I suppose, payment history, something should be done for them to help them get
I'd agree. I think the rules should stay there, because it has shown that it's proved successful, and it's proved an important rule to have in place. But I agree, like you have to, there has to be some type of wiggle room for those people who have shown that, look, like if you're it must be sickening for a potential buyer who's paying rent, which is going to be either the same or less than what a mortgage is going to cost, and they just can't get on the market and they want to buy a house. Like, that's just a killer.
Yeah, they need to do something for those people, because time flies now. Some of those people are maybe in their mid-30s and they're going to be 40 before they know it, and it curtails people starting families and all kinds of things. So I really think they need to look at that.
Yeah, good stuff.
Totally agree on that.
Excellent. Well, listen, thanks a million, Kevin. Kevin, you probably have a word or two on the old where you want to listen to, yeah, or we you can do that.
We could do, yeah. So on that, the podcast is released every 2 weeks. We'll be getting more property professionals like Owen on over the next coming weeks. Some exciting guests, some interior designers, some property developers. So do tune in wherever you get your podcasts, on Spotify, on Apple, and on YouTube. So that's a wrap on episode 4. Owen, Nick, thanks very much for popping on.
Thanks, guys. Thank you. Cheers. Take it easy.